Hello and welcome to the Connected Community Podcast. Today, my guest is Courtney Feider, who talks about her spiritual awakening when she had a near-death experience. Courtney came home one day. She was in her driveway in her car, and she was brutally attacked by a stranger who ripped her out of her car, gave her two black eyes, had a gun to her chest, had a gun to her head, and she ended up getting 10 staples in her head. It was absolutely a brutal experience, and she touched death in that moment and had a spiritual awakening. She had a lot of clarity in that moment, but she didn't know what to do with that clarity after. And so what I want to talk about in this episode is the integration process that takes place after a trauma, after a spiritual awakening. And what does that look like? It looks like hard work. Courtney went to therapists. She sought out advice. She educated herself, and she processed this with people in the community, her friends, her family, and multiple therapists. This is a very active process of transformation, not a passive transformation process. And so through all of that and through that spiritual awakening, she has been able to weave that into her personal life, into her relationships, and into her work. And is absolutely a brighter, better person today because of this experience, despite how incredibly painful and difficult it was. So I really hope that you'll find some inspiration from this podcast. If you're enjoying these, please take a moment to give us a like, a share, and a subscribe. And I want to thank you so much for being here today. Enjoy. Hello, and welcome to the Connected Community Podcast, a place to explore possibility through mindfulness, movement, and self-discovery. Our intention is to deliver insight and inspiration while fostering conversations that are genuine, unfiltered, and deeply human. We hope you will enjoy today's episode. Hi, Courtney. Welcome to the Connected Community Podcast.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. I'm so excited to speak with you today. I love your story. I love these stories of when somebody has a big event in their life and then it ends up transforming them and their whole personality and their whole trajectory in their life. And so I'm wondering if you could begin with your story. I'm wondering if you could share a little bit about the trauma that you went through.
Sure. So back in August 2016, I was moving my business from one container to another. I had young kids. I had a happy marriage. I had a great home. On the surface, everything was going really, really well. And I was in transformation in my business, but it was very linear. It was very moving this to that in terms of what I did and how I did it. And that was going relatively well, but there was this gap, like something was missing. And I'd been through that sort of trail before, so I was ready to wait for that. But one day I was coming home from work, my kids were at school, and I got home to my very quiet suburban neighborhood in the Pacific Northwest. Actually, I had to make a choice to go to a yoga class or to come home. And the coming home was coming home to like take a nap, like rest and really sleep, which I normally don't do. So to make that choice alone was like kind of monumental. And then I was in the process of writing a book. So all weekend I knew I was going to be working on it. So I was like, I'm just going to give myself some quiet time when no one else is home. So I live on a long easement driveway. I pull down the driveway, get the mail. I was on the phone with a friend in the car. And as I reached my parking spot in my driveway, a man came up to my window and knocked on the window and was asking me to get out. And he actually opened the door, which was very weird. And quickly I noticed he had a gun and he was there to essentially steal my car and all my things. So without every single shred of detail, the long story short is, of course, the normal things happened. I started to scream. I called for help, but I'm in a car. I'm down an easement. The neighbors weren't close by. Nobody could really hear me. And at the moment I understood no one could hear me, I felt the presence of these three Viking ancestors, which I had never noticed or felt or seen or connected with before. And they said, you need to fight. Don't give in. Don't give up. You're going to survive. You've done this before. You know how to do this. You're going to be okay, but you have to fight back. And they stayed there. They were there. They were present. I didn't see them, but I could feel them. And they were big. And I fought back. I didn't successfully fight back in terms of keeping my things in my car. He ended up ripping me out of the car, throwing me on the driveway. I had 2 black eyes, 10 staples in my head. He threatened me at gunpoint multiple times to my chest and my head, ripped my shirt from neck to waist.
Do you think did he have an intention to rape you?
Well, I didn't know at the time. You know, I was terrified about that. And that had happened to me previously. So I was doubly terrified about that.
Oh my God. Yeah.
But no, I don't think he did. We later found out he was extremely high and was running from police. He was on a bail bond and was literally staying in the neighborhood somewhere with a friend and was running from police and had stolen someone's gun and just wanted a getaway car. It took 2 years of court time and all this, but he was eventually convicted for 15 years to life.
Wow. And then you had to face him in court.
For 2 years.
Which is re-traumatizing, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. And the process is very weighted toward the system, the process. You know, like, he can delay this much for this thing. And just when you think you're at a turning point, you're not at a turning point. So it was very traumatic to go through the court process. I had to read a victim's impact statement that was very detailed in court with him there. His attorney interrupted me multiple times. That was in many ways worse than the attack. But this ancestral thing was super fascinating because in hindsight, I'd never connected with that. I was very spiritual, claircognizant when I was little, but I never really felt like I had full access. And even by the time police and emergency personnel got to my home and I was put in an ambulance and I was sitting there having this like crashing reality, like everything's changed. You can't really save anybody but yourself. You really have to think about focusing on what you're meant to do here and not harmonizing and fixing everything for everybody else, which I had done indefinitely over the course of my life. So, you know, that was a huge realization, which felt very delivered by those ancestors over the 2 years and past the court time, which was when I really started to actually integrate and heal, was like 2 years later. So yeah. I was kind of hanging on by my fingernails until then. I kept going back to that message and I kept going back to, you know, what I was meant to be doing, what I was spiritually guided to be doing and why. And it was very interesting too, because many, many times in very little ways, and still now, like progressively in a bigger and bigger way, there's been this opening to me understanding timing on things. Like, maybe don't get in your car for 5 more minutes. And then I drive and I see an accident, or, you know, just kind of wild stuff, like making me feel pretty infinitely protected. So somewhere around the 3-year-ish mark anniversary, and I kind of have a little ritual I do in the driveway every year, just to kind of give myself a moment to, you know, acknowledge that initiation and that change. I did see it as an initiation and I've called it that since then.
Yeah.
And really like accepted it as a gift and really understood that, not in this human plane, but on a spiritual level, I had karmic work with this man and it wasn't an accident that he found me.
Wow. And so when those three spirits appeared for you, and you said you weren't able to see them, but you sensed them. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah. And I mean, in a way I could visualize them. I'm not a person who, my gifts are not to see tactile forms of people. So there was a sense of how big they were, how tall they were, what they looked like. But, you know, they were essentially Viking warriors. They were very tall. They were very broad, all male, interestingly enough. Mm-hmm. There's another layer of all this progress that brought in a female to that too. But they all seemed in support of me, in charge of me in any way, more like, how can I put it? Like my guardians, if that makes sense.
Like I can't save you from this experience, but I can hold you and support you through it.
Right. Like imagine you have some kind of female who's, you know, important in a tribe or something. And there were these warriors that would protect her. It felt very like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like capable to a certain degree. I mean, as weird as that sounds, to go down the road of fighting back because they told me to, and they were there with me. They stayed with me through the experience. So, I think rationally later, I was like, very concerned this person would come back, right? Because he wasn't found for about a week and a half.
Oh my gosh.
And he had my garage door opener, my house keys, my car keys to my other car, you know, all my ID, my computer.
Wow.
And actually a handwritten version in a notebook of the book I was writing. So he had all of these very precious things and ways to identify me. Plus he knew where I lived, obviously. So it was, very self-defense focused on a certain level too.
Wow. And what do you feel when you say that there was that karmic connection with him that needed to be worked out? Can you talk about that?
Yeah. I mean, it came in waves. Like when I was initially in the ER, a couple of friends of mine that kind of heard what was happening, one of them showed up and she was like, "You just got an upgrade." That was her first comment. I had to sit with that. You know, later I could integrate it better, but I accepted it though. Like I felt what she said and I understood and I thought she was right. I mean, this was escalating violence from him. Like he had been involved in many other crimes, which was why he was in the position he was in, but he had never beaten anybody like this. Like he did beat me pretty severely. He, like I said, he tore my clothes. He beat my face. He threw me on the ground and I ended up with 10 staples here where I still have a scar. So, and I still have a dent in my forehead from the gun hitting my head with the butt of the rifle to knock me down too. So like he was aggressively working to injure me and legally they found that that was a big escalation of his behavior. And so there were several people that kind of said, wow, you know, if he had encountered someone else, like would he have just killed them?
Yeah.
I don't know. So, you know, and I can't speculate about that, but it did feel as if that was such a big turning point. My integration of it was, there was something familiar there. It was very, I can't really explain it to anybody who wouldn't necessarily have that spiritual belief, but I could identify him very easily in photos later. I felt that creepy karmic connection in court too. So there was something there.
I'm wondering when that was happening and unfolding, did it feel as if it went on forever? Or did it feel like it was in slow motion? Do you feel like you had mental clarity during that? Do you feel like your head was in the clouds a little bit?
I've heard other people with very, very different experiences describe near-death experiences, and it felt very much like the stories I hear about that. Like I felt outside my body and above myself. I felt most of the time, even though I was moving, obviously, and like, you know, resisting, I felt more like I was in presence with the ancestral spiritual beings than I was myself. I mean, I was separated from my body on a certain level spiritually. And it did feel very slow, very slow. I mean, it was probably a combination of what you mentioned, like time dragging out in slow motion.
Yeah.
Later, I recognized it was probably maybe 10 minutes max, probably not even that. But, you know, getting into my house and then, you know, turning my back on him, driving away, being terrified about that to just try and get into my house. And then, I mean, how do you call for help? Like, we don't have a landline. Nobody, no other adult was home. My kids didn't have cell phones there. So it's in that state trying to think like, how do I dial 911 on an iPad or a computer? Or eventually somebody else had called on my behalf. So
they did. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you were able to get away and then he escaped by foot?
No, in the car. He took the car.
Oh, that's right. Okay. He took the car. Yeah.
I resisted for a long time, but when he eventually hit me with the gun in my head and threw me down, you know, then I was in the driveway and he had to scramble to find the keys and things. Had a number of problems getting out of the driveway, but he did escape with the car and everything in it.
And when you were going through that fighting, did you feel like you had extra strength?
Yes and no. Like it was very, yes and no is the best I can put it, because I remember like processing that idea, you know, like that I would have adrenaline running. And of course I did, but also, this guy was incredibly high. And so he wasn't a huge person, but his ability to overpower me was, and plus he was lower than me because I was in an SUV. So he had the leverage to pull me. So there were times when I had my hand on the gun and was trying to turn it away from me. Like, and then I was afraid it would go off. Like, I mean, the number of things I had to process was kind of insane.
And so how long did that trauma stay with you? And do you still have flashbacks from that period?
Not at this point. I mean, it's very with me. It's almost like it's a grief point, you know. There's a gratitude obviously, but there's a grief. But I mean, it's been almost 8 years. So, you know, there has been a significant amount of time. I did all the things essentially. I immediately ended up with a grief related counselor who had come from the court system. She had been a victim witness coordinator before. So that was helpful because I didn't have to explain to her what was happening in the process.
Yeah.
And then there came a point where that sort of work with her was done and I opened that container with a separate person differently. And I did lots of different things like EMDR and lots of PTSD related kind of neurological reprogramming stuff because it was needed. You know, like it's my home. And so for a while immediately I was constantly vigilant, constantly up at night, worried about, you know, if he's in jail, who are his associates, and, you know, like just the endless container of feeling very exposed. But there was also a big layer of spiritual integration and a big layer of me integrating into my work. And I think because I was able to do both of those things and not sort of return to a day job, I had an extraordinary opportunity to integrate differently. And I really chose a highly spiritual path. I chose to look down shamanic roads and down, you know, different paths to get different professionals in different containers to give me their perspective. Mm-hmm. So that's been incredibly helpful. And then, like I said, it was a double-edged sword with my work because I didn't have a day job where I could just say, hey, I need time off or have a trauma leave or something.
Yeah.
Stands out a lot. The week and a half later, or whatever, when he was found, I was on the phone with a client trying to like sort of maintain a client relationship. Crazy. And my call waiting was clicking in, and it was the detective who had found him. And so I had to, you know, finish this call. And then I, you know, literally clicked over to the call where he's like, we found him. He's been, you know, detained with $1 million bond, blah, blah, blah. So it just felt so bizarre to have those two things happening so synchronously. And it was very much like other grief where, you know, lots of people rose to help for a pretty extended period, like through the court time. But the second he was imprisoned, everybody was like, and so you're good, right? And that was kind of the beginning of my healing, you know, like, so, and they didn't mean to do that in any malicious way, but they were exhausted too.
Yeah.
All the people who had been helping all that time.
So what was the most helpful transformational part of all the different things that you did to heal yourself that you really felt the biggest shift or something clicked in for you?
That's a really good question. I don't know that there's one specific individual thing.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things was working with EMDR, actually working on the neuroscience of breaking that connection and changing it. That was big. Yeah. But actually working with several shamanic practitioners and having them give me their perspective from different containers of shamanic work was really helpful too.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the biggest turning point was that moment where, and I can't tell you why it happened. It was kind of just the right time of integration where I could recognize this as something that was meant to happen to me, something that initiated me to a different way of being with people and offered me an opening and a gift to help people differently. When I started, you know, working with people as a coach and a trauma-informed coach, and they'd go down all these crazy roads with me and I could sit with that, I recognized that that was not that common, like that a lot of people in my field of work really struggle with that, or it's right on that razor's edge of moving more toward counseling. So it was something that I could at least walk down that road with them and help them seek additional help if they needed it. But to be, you know, holding space for other people's experience was a big part of the gift.
Yeah. The shamanic practitioners that you worked with, can you talk about how they worked with you?
Yeah, I mean, it a lot of different ways because I kind of looked into a lot of different containers. I mostly worked with people who had both some form of an ancestral or indigenous practice and then also some kind of intuitive gift. So they were able to give me some processing from the lens of what they'd studied, but also sort of what they intuited in conversation with me. And that gave me, I think, some validation around just understanding that I wasn't totally off my rocker thinking that I had had this spiritual experience. Initially, it was easy for me to make the spiritual part of it surreal too, while it was really, really acute. And it took some time to like accept that and to be able to speak it in too. You know, like there are a lot of people out there that don't necessarily look at the world that way. So
yeah,
right. Like, you had what happened? Are you sure? But then anybody in the world that I would speak to that had any kind of a near death, close call, really strong experience like that, they were immediately like, oh, I totally know what you're talking about. Mine was like this. And it was different, but parallel. So it, you know, it's given me this access to this different community of people. And when I encounter those people who have that spiritual reckoning, we can have a really different kind of conversation, which is pretty extraordinary. Yeah.
And did you, or do you now have the sense that those guides have always been with you, or they appeared at that moment when you needed them, or, and are they still with you?
Yes.
All that.
So, yeah. I mean, when I was very, very little, there was this level of claircognizance happening, but it wasn't necessarily something that my family practiced. You know, I came from a much more like Christian household back then. And so I didn't have any point of reference to that. It made me feel a little bit different when I was younger, but I didn't really understand it. And then progressively, I kind of let it open up a little bit more in my 20s and a little bit more and a little bit more. But really, I had never met those guides before that day in terms of understanding them and making them tangible. But I believe they probably had been there for me the whole time. And they're definitely still with me. And there's a more complex landscape to it now as well. And I think that it's actually older than this lifetime for me. Mm-hmm. I think that's where the karmic kind of conversation comes in.
Do you have the ability to access those guides whenever you need them?
Yes, I do. It takes concentration. It takes clarity. There are a couple different ways that I have gone there. One of them is through different forms of breath work. I can have some visualizations that bring them in and bring more clarity and depth to the story in. And then I did work with one other shamanic practitioner relatively recently, like last spring, who, as she talks to you through a story or your visualization, she'll have these like channeled songs that she sings to you. And that really brought it out too. So, you know, some of it I access kind of circumstantially by, you know, just appreciating these practitioners and wanted to be part mm-hmm. of their practice and experience them. But I did come to realize through all of that, that I do have shamanic abilities myself, and I always have, but I never saw it as that. So I've been able to organize that recently and understand how that falls into my life. Like I said, I was doing those things before, but I do those things with a different potency now.
Yeah. And so, mm-hmm. In my own personal life, I'm on this spiritual journey, and I feel like since last August, I've had this massive shift, and everything has rocked my world and flipped upside down. And all the things that I never believed in before, I'm kind of starting to believe in. And, but I know that when that happens for myself and for other people, and I've seen other people in the community, when you start going down that path, you do have to find kind of another community that understands your language.
Yes.
And so I'm kind of curious how that unfolded with your friends, your community, your family, your husband, and how that journey was for you stepping into that and embracing that and speaking from a place of clarity for yourself and honoring that and managing that around your relationships.
Yeah, it's a really good question. And it's complex for two reasons. I was a small business owner in this community. So the police immediately wanted to publish like my license plates and things to try and find this guy. And I really resisted them putting information out there because I was very worried about the community worrying. And progressively that did happen, where all these business owners and women were, you know, a little terrified. And so mm-hmm. I felt very responsible in a certain way, which I couldn't have, you know, done anything about, for their fear. So that was hard in the beginning. The other interesting element is in most of my work, especially now, I work with big corporations mainly. So I have this polarity where I speak corporate language and I work with these highly corporate people, and I'm bringing in like, I'm kind of almost smuggling in these spiritual elements because it's part of me, but I'm not making it tangible in those environments. And so you're right, I had to seek this other community. And I think part of the most difficult thing was finding the right way and time and place to start blending that and actually saying like, this is me and this is also me and this is all me.
Yeah.
Instead of, over here I'm this person and over here I'm that person. And, you know, if you'll know shaman me or if you know corporate me, I have had a couple of other shamanic people in my community, women who have started that blending too. So it's been really nice because we've been kind of like witnessing it with each other and having it. And it's true that blended community is really rare. Like, so you can find the shamanic community, but the blended community is uncommon and hard to find, but it's coming out a lot more. I'm actually impressed and happy to see that it's really surfacing. Like I'm starting to see it on places like LinkedIn, which I wouldn't have ever expected before. So that's been supportive recently, like the last year or so. And I see that growing and opening, and I'm happy about that. And I'm happy to be part of that. In terms of more personal relationships, I'm not hesitant to talk about it with people like my extended family, and also our belief systems are different. So they're not necessarily going to align with everything I say. They're not necessarily going to have the same experience that I have of the detail. So there's kind of, with a certain part of my friends and family group, there's this level, like, okay, Courtney, you were traumatized. So, and they just kind of give it a dot, dot, dot. And that's okay with me. Like, I don't need to convince them. Like, that's part of the gift here, is I don't need to persuade them that I write. In terms of my husband, we have a very open dialogue about deeper spiritual practices and things. And we have different ways of looking at it by quite a bit. But in essence, I think he just kind of sees it as my experience and believes that it's my experience. So he's had other spiritual experiences that I have not had. And there's a mutual respect there. So I'm fortunate that that's gone that way. Like,
yeah,
it could have gone a very different way in a different relationship. Mm-hmm. But that's been gentle. And yet I think there was a point where I was trying to bring him over to the side of, like, look at it through my eyes. And there was a point where that didn't make sense. Like, where it was like, just needed to be standing in mutual respect of each other's experience, because I don't need to convince anybody. And I also really have released the need to sort of, like, hide it. And also, I don't need to give that integration to every single person I meet. You know, working with a corporate team, they don't necessarily need this side of the story. It doesn't benefit our relationship. You know, that's kind of a lens I look through. It's like, does this bring more to what I'm trying to engage with this person or not?
Yeah.
But it, you know, it's refined my way of looking at friendship too.
How?
I feel after that experience, not necessarily down the shamanic road as much as that experience gave me the clarity of not really needing to be in harmony with every single person, not really needing to keep everyone in my sort of circle and gathering just because they had been at one point. I definitely didn't sort of, like, rip people out of my life after that. And at the same time, there was a clearing that happened. There was a sorting.
Yeah.
There were people that rose and came into the experience and were a pretty big part of it with us. And some of them are around now and some of them aren't anymore.
Yeah.
And then there were other people that stayed really far back from it and really couldn't deal with it, including parts of the family. And that's also okay. Like, you know, I kind of have to look at it like everybody had their own experience of my experience, if that makes sense. And that I've had so many additional amazing people come into my life since that I don't feel the loss of that.
Yeah.
You know, like, there's been a true balance in terms of who's with me now. And it's the right collection of people.
Yeah. And do you have the awareness of holding that trauma in your body, not now, but after the event? And then I'm curious, if you did, how did you release that? Or what was the most effective tool to release the trauma out of your body?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It took a long time for the physical part to release. Like, there were layers of it where my body released, you know, a couple days in some things. There was a lot of purging in terms of shaking or crying or rising fear and just general things that came out of, like, kind of solar plexus.
Mm-hmm. Before you go on, can you talk about the shaking?
Yeah. I understood prior to that event that trembling can be a release and a purge. You know, there's a lot of purging that can happen. You can sweat, you can cry, you can burp, you can laugh, you can shake. And also a big part of why I went into the EMDR practice was I could tell immediately I needed to right set my nervous system, because it all happened on my left side, which I also understood and studied to be the feminine side in many different cultures. And so that was very damaging, right? And so, but I wasn't evened out from a neurological standpoint. Like, my left leg would bounce. Like, I was having a nervous system trauma response.
Mm.
But I would also, in the middle of the night, in the vigilance and things, like, my whole body would shake.
Wow.
Or I'd have a night terror, or, you know, like, there were physical manifestations of release.
Mm-hmm.
And I was fortunate to have enough information to know that that's good.
Oh, like, yeah, it was awesome.
Shedding it was important.
Yeah.
And also, I think I thought I had gone through most of that. And then it wasn't very long ago, like 2021, there was a moment where some things happened in an emotional conversation where essentially that feminine side of me was depleted. And I had this enormous amount of low back pain that came in on my left side. And it was, like, pretty debilitating. Like, we were going on vacation to the Oregon coast and I was using, like, the seat heater the whole time. I was having a hard time the whole time we were on this trip. And I came back and I was like almost like bent in half and went to a chiropractor and they did some adjustments and that was good. And they checked to make sure nothing was structurally and that was good. But as they were physically moving things in me, I was like, oh, that's where I was ripped out of a car.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously. The interesting thing was I went through a series of treatments and physically you could hear things move, like things popping right back into place. And it took me having more of like a meditation on that release and some other personal practices and for that to really go away. And it has gone away. Mm-hmm. That and the other thing that helped it go away, interestingly enough, was starting to weightlift regularly. So like strengthening myself.
Yeah.
I think some of that's probably structural, but I think also there's a big mental part of my strength training practice now that kind of brings me in sync with that Viking perspective and that strength and ability and that ability to be protective of myself and mm-hmm. to continue working on my strength all the time. So I think that's been a big part of it too. But yeah, it's been a long road, mm-hmm. road. And I have every reason to know better. And I still only dealt with it in layers.
Yeah. Do you feel like it's hard to know. Do you feel like there's still layers underneath?
I mean, it's a little bit like, I think, losing someone to death unexpectedly or something where you don't have any sort of preparation for that. So like in the case of grief, you know, losing someone, you think, okay, I'll go through the memorial and then there'll be a couple weeks and a couple months and then I'll be fine. And that's really not the case. Like grief is shed in layers, right? Mm-hmm. Similar to that, it's very integrated for me. It doesn't feel like the center point. I realized I was keeping kind of the container of myself, like let's say from a kind of yoga standpoint, kind of the root chakra up, too open to everybody else's experience. And when I was able to start closing that and containing these gifts and the spirituality and stuff and holding it for myself and really going back to that message that I really needed to care for myself, you know, that coming in more and more in layers and waves has been the biggest turning point. So, mm-hmm. I mean, if I'm talking about real integration, truthfully, probably the biggest part of it started maybe last year, you know, but there was a lot before that that was on the trauma level.
Yeah.
But I really needed to absolutely disconnect from any point of reference to thinking that this was defined me or that I had any kind of label around victimhood or any kind of a label around trauma victim. So to that degree, mm-hmm. I've never been and can't be that person that's using this as my clarion call and putting it all over everything all the time. Usually that anniversary is my time to do that or very specific mm-hmm. callings like maybe today's conversation, but not to make it my calling card.
Mm-hmm. So I think this will be a tough question, but what would your advice be for people to move from that place of victimhood into empowerment? Because I think that's a huge shift with any trauma is to step outside of being a victim and having this thing happen to me to, okay, it happened and now I'm going to stand in my power.
I really, you know, for me, this wasn't my first trauma. So when I got to this point, I recognized that I had put all the bodies in coffins, but they weren't buried. Like I hadn't processed all the things that had happened to me and I had no more capacity. At the point where I began counseling, I literally had no room left to deal with any additional stress or strain or trauma.
Mm-hmm.
You have to really make space for new things to come in. So if you hold on to the identity of victimhood or you hold on to the traumatic event and you hold on to why me and, you know, questioning and the pain physically, first of all, I think anything you hold on to emotionally becomes physical. And mm-hmm. so it can so rapidly break down your health. From that perspective, I owe it to the journey I'm on to appreciate age, to work on my health all the time and work on letting go of these things all the time for that reason. In terms of having people move from A to B, I think the empowerment there is the more you identify yourself as through it and the more you identify yourself as how it's affected your life in a positive way or brought you to new things, the more you can clear space and make room for the new things. And you do need to make room for new things if you're going to move on. I really think that those who get stuck in that, they are the people that really suffer. There's addiction, there's suicidal tendencies. And, you know, all of that's understandable from my perspective. Like, I really don't think that I don't have any judgment of that. But I do think that it's a self-preservation thing that, you know, at a certain point you have to decide if you're going to save yourself. And at a certain point you have to decide who you're here for. Like in my case, if I had been single and had no children, my whole lived experience of this probably would have been very different because I wouldn't have had the same motivation to pull myself up by my bootstraps every single morning.
Yeah.
And also I think it's important to think like it takes time. Like you don't instantly have the release of that feeling of being a victim. And you almost have to, not almost, you absolutely have to name it in certain ways to have it go away. Like it's total shadow work in my opinion.
Yeah.
So, and I think a lot of us, especially in American culture, we really resist shadow. We really think that's my enemy and the light version of me is my best.
Yeah.
When it's really the combination of the two. You can't have one without the other.
Yeah. I almost feel like there's a point where things get really dark and heavy and that you make a decision if you're going to numb it out and push it down and push it down and push it down, or if you're going to face that. Are you going to keep numbing this with whatever it is? It could be medication, it could be drugs, it could be alcohol, it could be whatever the addiction is, or just pushing it away, because that feeling and those emotions are going to continue to rise, and they're going to continue to rise and rise and rise, and you're going to have to continue to shove it and push it down. Or are you willing to face those demons and the darkness and the hard part and move through it, knowing that you'll be able to handle it, that you won't be given more than you can handle, and knowing that there's support around that.
And I would just build on what you said by saying that I think some of it's choice, right? Some of it's recognition, and some of it's just getting out of denial, right? I mean, some of the self-preservation is, you know, I think that pushing down, there's a lot of things we can on the surface see, like, is it drugs, alcohol, whatever other form of numbing, but there's a lot of numbing that can happen without any of that.
Right.
It just has to do with like neglecting it. Right. And I think that's some of the main stuff that gets stuck in the body is just that neglect and that pushing down, that kind of like, I'll just compress this like a trash compactor and keep adding trash. Like it doesn't clear anything.
Right.
I think there's so much hiding from it. And I think about like indigenous cultures and how there's like a ceremony of integration for everything. And there's an elderhood that supports understanding how that community works with certain energies and grief and fear and coming of age and all this stuff. And we're really missing that.
Mm-hmm.
And I just really feel globally we're called to start finding how to do that again. So we have to pull together all these pieces, but the conversation isn't open. Like, where do people go for that chat? Where do they, hopefully they listen to podcasts like yours to hear these stories.
Yeah.
But I don't think we have a big enough container, particularly in the US.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm torn on that because in some ways I feel like that's, there's a rise in that, and there's a rise in consciousness. There's a rise in community. There's a rise in these topics being discussed more openly and not being taboo. And then I also, at the same time, feel like there's such a numbing in our culture, especially in America.
Mm-hmm.
There's such a numbing and such a denial, and there's so much anger and there's so much pain and not willingness to approach that pain. So it's interesting. Mm-hmm. I feel like there's these two things that are kind of rising almost at the same time.
Right. And when you say that, the thing that came up for me is I agree with you that, like I was saying, like I'm seeing it on LinkedIn now, which I'm shocked by compared to what I would have thought a few years ago. But I wonder if the talking about it is enough resolution. Because I think about some of the theorists that talk about the emotional loop and, you know, how we need to come full circle. Like in the animal kingdom, everything comes full circle, right? You know, it's death or they get away or whatever, but there's an end point. I feel like particularly in America, we have so much residue around these incomplete emotional experiences. And so I feel like the fact that we're opening it is amazing. And also, what next? What support is there for people that have opened it? You know, what do they do next? Where do they go? Who do they talk to? How do they process? And it's so individual and personal on so many levels. But I'm hoping that we can get to a point where we get a little closer to creating some more consistent systems of helping people metabolize, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Would you share your offerings and how people can connect with you and how you're spending your time helping others?
Yeah, definitely. So one easy way to connect with me is on LinkedIn. Another easy way to connect with me is at my website, thesewildhumans.com. I work in a variety of different ways, but I work a lot with bigger businesses to help them with resetting their nervous system and moving some of these blocks out. And I work a lot with the Enneagram to help people understand their behavior and their type and how they can just have better understanding of themselves. But also on my site, I have an access to a digital piece that's totally self-guided, very focused on women and focused on the Enneagram. And it's very gentle and it's all just audio practices and, yeah, and a resource library. And that's widely available for women as well. So I like having that resource that's just more personal. And then I try to share as much as I can on right now it's LinkedIn, so that I can offer little drips of support for free as much as I can to people who just need some kind of container of feeling like somebody understands what they're going through, but they're not really ready to go down the road of all the detail just yet. So yeah, those are the main areas of my work.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to thank you so much for sharing everything, your story and where you came from and how you processed it. It's a beautiful story of transformation. It's a beautiful story of going through one of the most horrendous things that you can imagine and then turning it into gold. So thank you so much for your time and for your story.
And thank you so much for having me and opening this conversation. That's so big. And I'll just offer the last thing I'll say is, you know, I feel like a lot has moved for me, but there's always more, right? There's always more work in progress, and getting to the place where you can talk about these things and have them in the discussion is big, but we're all work in progress.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. All right, Courtney, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Connected Community Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, please like, share, and subscribe. I can be found at www.nikkiyyoga.com, NikkiYyoga.com. Until I see you again next week, I hope you have a beautiful day.